All right. Now for the moment you've all been waiting for, it is my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, so please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to Cindy.
Hi, I'm Cindy. Is it tall enough? No? I'm Cindy and I'm an alcoholic. There's a lot of people out there. And I haven't done this in a long time, so bear with me. It'll be what it'll be. My sobriety date is October 20th, 1997. And I'm very much looking forward to celebrating 20 years if I don't take a drink one day at a time. I have been thoroughly socialized into those five-year increments by Hallmark or whatever, but 20 seems pretty damn good to me, so I'm looking forward to that, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, how I wound up here, and what it's been like since I got here, and seeing as how I have I've almost been sober as long as I drink. Not quite, but I'm getting there. I'm looking forward to being able to say that in a meeting shortly, you know. But I grew up, you know, down the road at Fresno, and I grew up in a good family. You know, neither of my parents were alcoholic. We were, you know, church-going folks, and, you know, I grew up going Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, you know, did the church thing my whole young life. And, but I also had a lot of feelings. I don't know if you had feelings when you were young, but my feelings really messed with me a lot, and I tried to escape them from as young of an age as 5. That was my first attempt to leave planet Earth. I went out in the backyard. We had a stump in the backyard that had a red ant's nest on it, and I decided that I was going to go sit on that stump, and those red ants were going to eat me alive, and I was going to die and go to heaven. And because that was what I was taught at Sunday school, that, you know, that's where all the great stuff happened, was heaven. It certainly wasn't here. And so I was looking forward to sitting on Jesus' lap, and everything was going to be okay. And instead, I just got bit all over by red ants, and my mother came out there and you know, hosed me off. She's like screaming at me, "What are you doing?" And so that suicide attempt did not go the way I'd planned. The next one was probably a little slightly less dramatic. You know, I was 12 and at a church function out of town when I decided to down a bottle of aspirin. And, you know, so that all that did was put me in the emergency room because they walked in when I was finishing up the bottle. And so, you know, and my family, that kind of stuff was a little too serious to deal with. So it was kind of, you know, they brought me home from that trip, and my dad just quipped, you know, "I guess we better put the aspirin on the top shelf," you know, and I was 5'9" already by then, so that was just, didn't really mean that, but, and, you know, and then there were several things just for attention. I was in a class in middle school. It was a drafting class, and we had X-Acto knives in there, and I threatened, you know, that I was going to slash my wrist. I was all dramatic. By this time, I think I was just wanting attention. You know, my serious attempts hadn't worked out, so let's try something new here. And the teacher said, "Well, make sure you do it vertically and not horizontally," because and he regretted that, because I took my X-Acto knife, and yes, I still have that scar, you know. And And, you know, he was this, everybody gets ushered out of the room, and he's back there trying to bandage up my wrist and, you know, keep it on the down low. And, being in the field of education, I understand why he was so nervous. But, I never told anybody about it, and he certainly didn't tell anybody about it. And so it was very shallow. It was just really a pay attention to me kind of thing, I guess. And I'm very grateful that they did not have classrooms for emotionally disturbed kids back then, because that's the kind of teacher I became later. And that's the kind of student that we got, you know, sent to those classes, if they weren't externalizing behaviors, you know. So I say all of that to let you know that even though when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought the only thing wrong with me was that I couldn't stop drinking. And I was about 2 years sober when someone brought up, you think you had it all together before you ever picked up the first drink, you know? And I really, that's when I thought about it for the first time and realized that, you know, maybe I didn't have it all together before I picked up the first drink. I can remember just being suicidal from a really young age, high school, thinking about it, talking about it, and I would poll people because I really thought that more people should feel the way I felt. I would be like, well, you know, haven't you ever thought of killing yourself? And they'd be like, no, God, no, you know. And so I started to pick up on the fact that, you know, maybe I wasn't just like my fellows, but I think had I had a little bit of the wisdom that I got in AA, excuse my language, but when I got here, they told me to fuck my feelings. And had somebody told me that when I was 12, I would have been a lot better off. So, you know, that's the wisdom that I get here. And it's paid off in sobriety quite well. So my first drunk, I'm not going to, you know, the first drink was all the same thing that a lot of us do, you know. You go get the beer for your brother or your dad and you get a sip. My sister did say that one time when I was about 11, we shared a bedroom and I got into the closet and she had a bottle of apricot brandy in there, and she said I drank almost like all but just like the bottom, and I don't remember that except for the fact that it tasted really good. I never had apricot brandy later on, but I did get really sick on just brandy, so maybe the apricots are the trick on that one. But I was still doing the deal, you know, so going to church, being very active, going to camp, doing all those things. And I was invited to my sister and her husband's house in Sacramento. And he was a big drinker. You know, she was just kind of she was pregnant. She wasn't drinking much of anything. But this was the first time that somebody was pressuring me to drink. And my brother-in-law just flat out said, well, let's get the good little Christian girl drunk. And he, you know, I kept saying, no, thank you. I don't want any. No, thank you. I don't want any. You know, and pretty soon I buckled under and had the first drink. And then I drank another one and another one. And that did not lead me anywhere good at all. He got drunk as well. We went for a walk. It was, you know, supposedly to try to sober me up. And he made a pass at me, and I started crying. And then they locked me out on the porch to sleep because they were afraid I was going to get sick all over their new carpeting. And this guy, I was 16, and this guy who'd been a guest for dinner, who had seen them lock me out, came back and raped me on the porch. So, you know, that's how my first drunk went. And like a lot of us, you know, I swore off after that. You know, that was never going to happen to me again. And I blamed myself completely, you know. I was the good little Christian girl who should not have had a drink. And so that swearing off lasted I think, you know, I used to think it lasted longer than it lasted, and then the memories start coming back to you when you get sober, but I think it lasted about a year and a half, you know, and then what had been the problem or the cause of the most painful thing I'd ever been through became the solution. You know, I had more feelings to escape, not less, and I started to drink to get drunk, and I did that. You know, I kind of think of the progression of my alcoholism as kind of the textbook case. You know, it was the starting the weekend partying kind of drinking, and then as the years went by, it crept up to the happy hour on, you know, Thursdays and then Wednesdays. And pretty soon, it's towards the end of my drink. I drank for 20 years, and at the end of the last 3 years of my drinking, I was a morning drinker. I was a daily drinker. I had a giant bottle of vodka in the trunk of my car. I had a small bottle of vodka in my purse that went with me everywhere. And I could not ever drink enough to escape all the feelings that I had, real or imagined, you know. You know, over those 20 years, I went to college, I got married, I adopted two children. My husband and I adopted two children, and I can remember as my drinking was progressing, how guilty I felt because I adopted these children out of foster care, and they have a mom that is a mess. You know, they have a mom that is drinking and passing out on the couch when she's supposed to be mothering. I remember one time my little girl was dancing around while I was passed out, and she knocked over my rum and coke glass and broke it and cut her foot, and I had to, you know, throw her in the car with my infant son and drop him off at my husband's work with him so I could get them to the emergency room and drive drunk to the emergency room to get her taken care of. I drove drunk all the time. I, you know, as I did not want to drive drunk. And I remember clipping this little article from the paper about a 36-year-old woman who killed three people in a drunk driving accident. And I had that in my jewelry box. And every time I went to put on my watch in the morning, I saw that article. And I would say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to drink today. I'm not going to drive drunk. And by that evening, I was drunk again. You know, it's just pure luck. I don't like to say but for the grace of God, because I believe God's grace falls on all of us. It's nothing that he doesn't want me to be sober and somebody else not to. I think he wants everybody to be sober. But eventually things got bad enough that I decided perhaps I need some therapy. And well, what made that decision was I went out to the Smuggler's Inn. I don't think it's called the Smuggler's Inn anymore, but if you all know the Smuggler's Inn in Fresno, with my sister, we went drinking in the bar. We closed the bar down, and these two guys that we were talking with invited us back to their room to smoke some weed. And I wasn't a big weed smoker, but I wasn't done, you know. So my sister left, and I was driving, so she made me take her home, and I, you know, drove over a few islands and things to get there. And I finally get back, and I walk into the entrance of the Smuggler's Inn, and I'm just plastered, and I'm like, I didn't know the guy's room number. The bar's closed. You know, there's just this long hallway of rooms. And I started like, these guys invited me to their room. And blah, blah, blah. And pretty soon I'd see a head poke out down there. So they could actually, it was loud enough and obnoxious enough they could hear me. And, you know, they spot me. And I come on down, you know. So, but I went in. I smoked a little weed. You know, I wound up at home 4 or 5 in the morning, which had become a pattern. And my husband, being the good codependent that he was, you know, you're not supposed to say Al-Anon, because an Al-Anon is someone who's a member of Al-Anon. They're supposedly working a program, so they don't like it when they're, you know, constantly stuck with that codependent tag. But at that time, he was not in Al-Anon yet, and so he would have, I found out later, that he would have already done his raging because I wasn't home, and he would have already broken a few things and messed up a few things, and then he'd given up and go to sleep by the time I crawled in. So by the time I'm crawling into bed, he's sound asleep, I'm thinking, no big deal, you know, it doesn't bother him, it's okay. And I really thought, when I got sober, I really thought that he just didn't mind. You know, it's just my sponsor saying, like, what planet are you from that you think that a husband is not going to care that his wife comes home at 4 or 5 in the morning, you know? I mean, and he was very subtle in expressing his displeasure, because things like locking the deadbolt, you know, like I'm going to notice that there's an extra lock I have to undo when I'm drunk, you know, coming through the door, or turning off the porch light. That was another one. You know, he told me these after I got sober. He'd turn off the porch light to signal his displeasure. And I like, even sober, I'm much too dense to get that one. So, yeah. But the worst thing he ever did was, I had hunted, and I hate to shop, and I needed a pair of leather shoes, and I had finally found some, and they were never been worn, still in their box. And I wake up one morning, I go into my closet, and they're sitting in the box, twisted, like those donut twists, you know, with the, and just totally twisted. And this is, we're talking the most this husband's ever done is, like I said, turn off the light or something. So I said, oh my God, what happened to my shoes? I'm thinking some kind of weird humidity, drying out, you know, something happened. And he looks down at the ground and he goes, I did it. I was totally shocked. Why would you do such a thing? You know, I thought he was insane. And it just turns out he was a little pissed off that I, you know, was never coming home. And so after that night at the Smugglers, even I got a little scared over that one. I skipped a lot of stories. I skipped the Lost Lake with the motorcycle guy pulling a gun on me. You know, I all the things that I was getting myself into as a drinking woman that didn't have a brain in her head. And so, you know, to be at that age, which I was in my 30s, and I had a profession, and I was raising two children, and, you know, when I woke up and I was looking at myself in the mirror thinking, God, I went to the hotel room with a couple guys I didn't even know, you know, and even they, you know, it was always my luck. If I hitchhiked, I would get a lecture after the hitchhike. You really shouldn't do this, you know. It might not be a guy as nice as me, you know. Or that's what they said, you know. You really shouldn't wind up in a hotel room with people you don't know. It might not be as nice a guy as we are. So I was just totally, totally scared by that situation, and wound up calling and getting a therapist and going to therapy for about 6 months. And that was the first time I tried to quit drinking as far as officially, you know. I was always pouring booze down the drain, always trying to quit, because I very clearly recognized it as the problem, because I did not grow up in an alcoholic home. My behavior and my drunkenness was very obvious to me that it was a problem. It rang a lot of alarms. And so the therapy didn't work. He did suggest that I go to AA, though. This is about 3 years before I got sober, so I went to, I remember going to 9 meetings. I was counting them. And I never, you know, I always went drunk. I mean, how would you walk into a place like this sober, you know? I mean, And I wasn't hearing correctly. Every time they said, if you have less than 30 days, please introduce yourself, I heard, if you have 30 days, please introduce yourself. So I never introduced myself, and I would go home thinking, how's anybody ever going to know? I can't stop drinking if they never let me say my name. You know, I mean, I didn't realize, you know, yes, I know how intuitive you all are now, and you can smell it, you can spot it from a mile away, but at that time, I didn't realize it was that everybody knew each other in the room either. You know, I mean, I would walk in and just a group of people. I didn't know that they would, anyway. And I didn't stay sober, and so I just kept doing what I did until, you know, I finally hit my bottom about 3 years later, and I knew where to go, you know. So introducing me to AA wasn't such a bad thing, but by then I was directed to going to a rehab, outpatient rehab, because I was still active in church, and I was kind of the church drunk by this time. So, you know, I was getting little lectures like, you know, you're fired from Sunday school. You know, maybe you should get it before you try giving it away. You're off the worship team, because I was showing up to rehearsals pretty well drunk and obnoxious, and that was a fun amends. That was a group amends. That sucked. Fast forward, I made it. I made it to AA because, you know, when you drink for 20 years, you could talk a long, long time about your drinking. And but I've almost been sober 20 years, so I can talk a while about that too. So I did make it to AA, and I was not a willing participant. I hated Alcoholics Anonymous, actually. You know, I wasn't one of those people that came in and said, "Oh, I'm home," you know. I was like, this is boring. I remember saying after a meeting once, when they dragged me to coffee, "You're like a bunch of hogs wallowing around in the mud." That's what, you know, that's the beautiful newcomer that I was. And someone would hand me their phone number, and I would rip it up right in front of them and toss it in the trash. You know, I just, giving up my tools for life, which were vodka, gin, and rum, you know, was extremely hard on me, what can I say? And I was always a fairly independent person, I thought, except for dependence on alcohol. And so the thought of depending on other people to help me stay sober, it just wasn't anywhere in there, you know? And so little, you know, it was baby steps. It was hooking up with a group that, like, who cares, you know? Keep coming back. You know, they just laugh at me. I wasn't a smoker, so when they're all sitting there smoking and they, you know, have all this time, right, 10, 20 years, and I'd be like, well, when are you going to work those 12 steps on that filthy habit of yours? You know, I mean, and they would just smile and say, keep coming back, Cindy, you know? Or to get me to coffee, it was just come for 2 minutes. Just 2 minutes, that's all you have to come. And I would come and sit my butt in that chair, and I would hold my wrist just like this. And 2 minutes, boom, I was gone. And, you know, they knew something I didn't know. You know, they knew that if I kept coming back long enough to hear a little bit of hope, that I might actually stick around long enough to come back because I want to come back, not because I had to come back. And that's what happened. I mean, I kept, I hooked up with a group that, you know, my sponsor required me to go to 5 meetings a week from the very beginning. And I had 2 children, and I was working 3 jobs, and, you know, and it didn't matter. It was like, you're going to do what do what I say, do what everything, I just do it. And I was willing to, because I was tired of living that way. I mean, I didn't even, you know, the hangover, when I think about just the hangovers alone, you know, who would voluntarily put their body through that over and over and over again? I mean, you know, if it was an allergy to strawberries or something that had me dehydrated 3 days later and sick as a dog and still can't get out of bed, I would never touch another strawberry. I'm sorry, but I do have a little bit of ability to learn from my mistakes, and but alcohol, you know, that's where I really got the concept of alcoholism as a disease, and the reading about the doctor's opinion and reading that and thinking, oh my God, it makes so much sense. I couldn't even drink 2 glasses of milk myself, but I certainly couldn't drink 10 glasses of milk. But if you put a little Bailey's in there or something, I could easily drink 10 glasses of milk. Orange juice, Coke, whatever, you know, vodka and orange juice, rum and Coke. You put a little booze in it, and I can down it one after the other. But I've never had, like, more than 2 or 3 Cokes in an entire day in my life, you know? But boy, have I gotten sick from drinking alcoholic beverage after alcoholic beverage. And that was what really convinced me that I have an allergy. I have a disease that makes me crave alcohol and continue to want to put it in my body, and my body tolerates amounts that, you know, my husband certainly doesn't tolerate. In fact, that Leaving Las Vegas, you know, that movie, I remember watching that early in sobriety and sitting on the couch, and I wanted to drink every day for the first 7 months. I remember exactly, because I had to go to a family reunion, and the daily obsession was lifted, like, right before I went to that family reunion. I was so, so worried about that. But every day, I wanted to drink. And I was hanging on. I was just hanging on by going to meetings and calling and having people babysit me. I would call. I would literally say, can you hang out with me today? I want to drink, you know? Can you go shopping with me? Or can you, I mean, I wasn't even a shopper, but I would do, I even said to my sponsor, I don't need somebody to go White Flower Macy's shopping with me. I just need not to drink, you know? And I'd be like, God, it's so embarrassing when I remember those things. They're like the last thing in the world that woman wanted to do was go anywhere with me. So, anyway, I just... obnoxious, arrogant, but desperate and willing, and that's what saved me from by that time, you know, I was planning my suicide. I'd already checked in with the insurance agent to make sure that we'd had our policy long enough that I could kill myself and still leave a little bit of money to my family. I swore him to secrecy, like as if it, you know, I don't know if an insurance agent is like a priest and can't say anything, but I treated it like that, and I was at the end, and so coming to AA saved my life physically. I know for a fact that I was hanging in because I had kids that I had adopted out of foster care, and I was not going to do that to them. I was not going to leave them motherless. But boy, as soon as they were going to be out of the house, you know, that if I'd still been drinking, I know that would have been a done deal. If I was still alive, if I hadn't killed somebody and gotten locked up in Chowchilla or killed myself. I did, in sobriety, I did a lot of service to stay sober. Somebody roped me into taking meetings into Chowchilla Women's Facility. It was a man that was doing it by himself, and he said, I really need a woman, and I just need a partner. And he went with me one time, and then he dumped me, and then it was up to me. And I did that for 3 years. I took meetings monthly into Chowchilla Women's Facility. And the reason that I did that, I'd never been to prison, I'd never been to jail, never been arrested. But in my drinking, I was always trying to prove that I was a worthwhile human being, even though I was a drunk. And so I had been in the Match 2 program and Friends Outside program, and sometimes I was mixing drinks and drinking them on 99 on the way to visit somebody in Chowchilla, and I can remember sitting there drunk and having the inmate sharing with me that she was there because of alcohol, and just feeling like just a, you know, this big, and I hadn't learned that lesson yet that my pastor tried to drill into me. You know, maybe you should get it before you try giving it away. So that was my amends after I got sober, was taking those meetings into the prison. And, you know, I worked those 12 steps. Like I mentioned, that group amends, you know, having to go in there and make amends to lots and lots of church people, and they're very nice if you have to make amends to them. some of the more humiliating ones were when I went to make it to this brother and sister, because I had gotten drunk and gone to a party at somebody's house, and it wasn't, you know, it was a church person's party. It's not the kind where you're supposed to show up drunk off your ass riding your motorcycle, and I proceeded to dance with all the young teenagers in ways you probably shouldn't dance with young teenagers. And when I went to make amends to those teenagers, they just sat there petrified, because they just knew that I was coming to speak with them, and I was teaching college at the time, and they thought that they were in trouble for their grades. And so it was very humbling to sit there and know I'm here because I'm an alcoholic, and because my behavior on such and such a night was this and that, and it was wrong of me to, you know, set that kind of example for you, and blah blah blah. But I made the amends, and I did everything that my sponsor told me to do. Does that mean that today, that if she shares an opinion that I disagree with, that I'm going to run out and do it her way? No, I've stayed sober long enough that I'm going to gather my feedback. I'm going to make my pros and cons list. I'm going to pray. I'm going to take the steps and use the tools that I've learned here. But I didn't have those tools when I got here. I was driven by my emotions. If it felt right, it must be right. And that included how I treated you. If I did not like you, it would be hypocritical of me to treat you nicely. And I really believed that. I thought that I was being honest when I would be mean to people that I didn't like. Or, I learned that it doesn't matter how I feel, that I treat people with respect and kindness and compassion, and fuck my feelings. You know, that is not the important thing. It doesn't have to drive me. In sobriety, I've been through a lot of hard things. I lost both of my parents in sobriety. I lost my husband's parents in sobriety. I lost two of my closest friends that I had when I got sober in the first couple years. That first death was horrible to get through sober. I can remember sitting at my dining room table in my pajamas. I couldn't move. I couldn't do anything but cry. And on the phone with my sponsor, and she's like, "Have you brushed your teeth? Hang up the phone and go brush your teeth. Call me when you're done." You know, "Have you gotten dressed yet?" "No." "Hang up the phone. Go get dressed. Call me when you're done." I mean, she watched me. I was able to have the service for that woman in my home. And but she just watched me through that first experience sober with death. And my children have had their fair share of problems. My daughter is, she has mild mental retardation, which is now called intellectually challenged, and she also has bipolar disorder, and she was very, very difficult to raise. and on top of that, she's now she's trans. She hasn't gotten the surgery, so I'm trying to use the right pronouns all the time, and it's life has not been a piece of cake since I got sober. The first time she was hospitalized when she was 13, I just bawled her empty bedroom, you know, in the hallway. I just bawled and bawled and bawled day after day after day. And she's been hospitalized many, many times since then. And the police has been called many times. She lives a block away from me. Today, and it sometimes I have to leave town and turn off the phone because I just have to have that break. But I have been able to walk through everything, every challenge, you know, without taking a drink, and I don't have to do it gracefully, and I don't know if I'll ever do it gracefully. I don't really think it matters, truthfully. I mean, when we see it in other people, we want it, you know. Oh, I wish I could go through that problem, or go through that death, or go through the experience with that kind of serenity and peace and just forgiveness, whatever the situation is. But I know when it's me going through it, I just want to not drink. You know, I just want to show up to my meetings and put one foot in front of the other, not fall completely apart. And I know that other lesson, besides not having to let my feelings dictate my behavior, is that this too shall pass. And because I was able to walk through those sober things and stay sober through all the tough things that have gone on, I know the next time that I'm going to be able to stay sober if I do the same thing. And, you know, I had the list of the things I knew I would drink over when I got here, and I actually had them written down. I don't know if any of you have ever done that, but I wrote it down, and it was mostly had to do with, you know, if I lost a child, you know, I would definitely drink over that. If this happened, if that happened. And, you know, there's no list today. There is nothing in my life that could happen that would make me drink. I have seen too many people show the way, and they sat in rooms and they were a mess, and maybe they were a mess at every single meeting for years. I mean, losing a child is horrific. You don't just get over that. So, but I got to watch people. What they did show me was that they knew that a drink wasn't going to make it better. A drink wouldn't bring their child back. And so I know that today. I know that if I keep doing what I've been doing for the last, you know, 19 years and change, if I keep doing that, which happens to be, number one, don't drink, and go to commitment meetings where people know you and notice when you're not there, call your sponsor, work those steps, sponsor others. Prayer and meditation, my idea, my concept of a higher power has completely changed since I got sober. But it is broadened to the point where I know that my God wants a good and wonderful and happy and fulfilling life for each person in this room and everybody else on the planet. So I believe that God's will is for all of us to have that. And God's grace is there for all of us. So thanks.